Mormon Discussions and its lineup of great podcasts is about helping Latter-day Saints like you tackle deeper, complex issues within Mormonism.
All financial support goes directly towards keeping these podcasts alive and supporting listeners like you.
To support the programs on this podcast, please consider becoming a premium subscriber
or making a donation at mormondiscussions.org. Again, that's Mormon Discussions, plural with an S on the end, .org.
Donate today and support programs like Mormon Discussion, Radio Free Mormon, Mormon Awakenings, The Mormon Wellness Project,
Mormon History Podcast,
Marriage on a Tightrope, and others.
If these programs benefit you
and you want to see these continue, please consider making an annual donation starting today.
All donations are tax exempt inside the United States and go towards keeping the podcast alive.
Mormon Discussions and its lineup of great programs
helping you navigate Mormonism one episode at a time.
Welcome to the Mormon Wellness Project. I'm Wendy Perry, back in the therapist chair. For a long time, I was calling this episode Facing Down the Devil, Saving Our Children from Abuse. But who is the devil? Perpetrators? I guess that's what I was thinking. But what about bad policies? What about benign neglect? What about all of us who don't even want to think about it? Hey, I'm one of the worst. If something comes on the TV or radio talking about child neglect or abuse, I'll leave the room or cover my ears and go, la 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 la, like a kid. But not when I'm working. If you come to my office for therapy, there's nothing you can throw at me that will get me off my game. Because that's where I have control. That's where I might make a difference. And that's where training, preparation, knowledge, and practice kicks in. And that's all I want for leaders, to have some of that stuff. But when it comes down to it, as usual, the devil is really in the details. The sometimes tedious, difficult to hear details. And that's what this podcast is about, but it's also about real people I've known in cases I've worked. I originally added a lot more stuff about pedophiles, but I took it out. You can look it up yourself if you need more information. I felt it was getting me off the track of what I really wanted to say, which is where the new title comes in. Fresh Courage Take, Protecting Kids from Sexual Abuse. Because courage is really what we need. We need to stand and face this evil down. We can't pretend it's going to go away, because new pedophiles are always going to be growing up among us, and new batches of kids are being born who need information. New leaders will be called to positions who haven't been trained. And I really believe that's where the church will land. We can't continue to be the only church who doesn't train our ministers, especially when it's a lay ministry and when case after case shows that relying on discernment is a recipe for disaster. I hope one of the takeaways from this will be that listeners can catch a glimpse of just how complicated these cases are. There are so many competing forces. The parents, the relatives, the friends, law enforcement, the legal system, it just goes on and on. And the church in the mix adds to the complication, but it could be a real force for good if we get it right. And a couple of notes. I made this episode in the style and use of language, so it might be valuable for training or church purposes. If anyone even cares, who knows? But I didn't call anyone a douchebag, so good for me. Also, in the scenario with the bishop, when I have the conversation about the kids seeing the uncle on the camping trip, what I meant to say was that he was seen in an outdoor shower. So he's innocent, see? Get it? Otherwise it makes no sense, because a camping trip might be a perfect scenario for an uncle to abuse a child. Well, maybe that's intriguing enough to encourage you to listen to this whole podcast. I promise you, you will learn lots of new stuff, and it'll get you thinking. And one final thought about courage. Courage isn't bravery. Courage is the combination of strength, motivation, and determination, with a good dose of give a damn thrown in. See, I managed to swear after all. By this shall men know ye are my disciples, if you give a damn about kids. Well, that about sums it up in my book. So, now on to class, kids. For the better part of this year, so far in the progressive Mormon community, we've been focusing a lot on how to protect children, and particularly with regard to interviews of a sexual nature with leaders in the church, like bishops. The church has made the allowance that the kids are allowed to ask for someone to be in the room with them for these interviews. We're making some progress, but I also want you to think of this. What if there's a situation of incest? What if there's a dad or mom who is absolutely thrilled the child will never be alone with the bishop? So we're going to talk about disclosure today. I don't know how many times a child has revealed sexual abuse to a bishop and has been given help. Probably, from what I've been hearing, the bishop simply doesn't know what to do, does the wrong thing, or doesn't pick up on the clues. But I hope once in a while it's worked. And as long as the church is going to allow bishops to discuss sexual issues with children, we need to make this very clear caveat. When I said I don't want kids to be alone with any adults, I meant adults who haven't been trained. I certainly would allow my child to go in with a play therapist, for example, or a psychologist, if I had done my research and know they were well trained. And there are many reasons for this, but particularly when we talk about people who have everyday interactions with kids, leaders of religious groups, family, or child-centered organizations, as well as teachers and therapists, are primarily situated to be a place where kids just might feel safe telling about abuse. I'm going to put the word telling in quotes because children are terrified about telling, but they do want the abuse to end. So they are always in a state of dissonance and hypervigilance. And this is very important. Most child sexual abuse is discovered by accident, sort of. I had a recent case where a young girl who had been abused by her brother for a couple of years was in the car with her mother. Something came on the radio about sex. Just before she jumped out of the car to go to her swimming lessons, she blurted out, "Oh, that's what so-and-so brother does to me." For some reason, she saw a chance and took it. These kids are like prisoners cycling between two different types of hypervigilance. They're extremely anxious and worried about the secret getting out, while at the same time nurturing a secret agent inside who is constantly scanning for something that looks like it might give them even the smallest possibility of escape. Think of every prison escape movie you've ever seen. You'll get an idea of what I'm talking about. You're looking for even one person who might be safe to talk to. You're listening carefully, watching, waiting for just the right moment. Victims of sexual abuse as children, and even later in life, are always testing the waters to see who is safe. So when they sit down with the Mormon bishop or any other trusted adult, they might send out tiny clues and watch for the reaction. If a bishop talks about modesty, for example, uh-oh, he's getting close. And the child may wonder if they should say something. So they try it. They throw something out there. Well, I saw my uncle's bottom once. At this point, the bishop may feel uncomfortable and may even chuckle slightly. Oh, was that on a camping trip or something? The child immediately knows this is not his or her chance. There will be no prison break today. Yeah, it was a camping trip. Back to the bishop. Okay, well, that's not what we're talking about today. In fact, we're talking about the kind of clothes you wear. And the bishop moves on. I'm going to list four important things that you need to know about disclosure, children who disclose sexual abuse. Number one, children who disclose sexual abuse often do tell a trusted adult other than a parent. Again, for this reason, training the people who work with children is essential. Two, children may tell portions of what happened or pretend it happened to someone else just to gauge the adult's reaction. Three, children will shut down and refuse to tell more if you respond emotionally or negatively. Not responding emotionally or negatively. It takes a lot of training and practice. And the fourth one is also very important. Children will change their story or recant. They will see the emotional response of adults, which will be very scary to them. They will see the full range of human emotions on steroids, even if they are believed. While everyone is going nuts around them, trying to figure out what to do, who to talk to, who to believe, maybe part of it's true, could the child be imagining things or making it up? During all of this, the child is watching and may think that it would have been better not to say anything at all. What would you be thinking if instead of making dinner, mom was in her room crying for 3 hours? What would you do if the police, relatives, people from the church were parading through your house talking about you and the most secret and shameful family in the case of incest? And if the perpetrator is someone outside the immediate family, mom and dad will both be around, maybe interviewing you, talking to you. But they probably won't agree on how to handle everything. You can hear them in the other room, arguing about what to do, crying, yelling, going silent. What would you do? I hope you can understand why children recant or minimize the abuse, try to rewind. And they also see other kids in the family. It's not uncommon for other siblings to blame the victim. If it wasn't for you, stupid, dad wouldn't have to leave. Why would you say that stuff about dad? You know he would never do anything like that. You're nuts. That's what kids hear. The pressure is immense. The kids are going to all kinds of appointments, being grilled by CPS, the police. We're trying to get to the child before the pressure to recant becomes too great. I've seen this right before my eyes. And if you're not on the same page as the mom, you can become the enemy, and fast. Her maternal instincts are at their most heightened. She wants to protect the child from abuse, but she also has to think about the entire family, putting food on the table and paying the mortgage. She thinks of the cost of everything, the lawyers, the court costs, the counselors, the missed time from work. And she will be losing friends fast as the word gets out. In a religious congregation, this is even more traumatic. In the Mormon church, for example, she will be also worrying about her husband or child standing in the priesthood. She's thinking about her temple marriage. What does it all mean? She will vacillate between denial and rationality for a long time. In the midst of all this, the one thing the kid needs to be believed is in question. And the child begins to really wonder, was it worth it? And that's how it begins, and that's how it continues. For a long time, unless the child gets help, and unless the parents allow the child to stay in counseling long enough, and not bolt and say, oh, they're fine, they're doing just fine. Ugh, so frustrating sometimes. I recently watched a 10-year-old girl in my ward, in an encounter with a man probably in his late 40s, in an uncomfortable situation. He's a big, old, gregarious guy who really likes to hug all the young women. It's a side hug, and probably innocent. But he kind of grabbed her over to him and hugged as she tried to pull away. But that wouldn't do for him. He grabbed her again, and with his strength, literally forced her into a longer hug. She was smiling, but kept looking down. I couldn't take it. As soon as she left, I walked up to him and said, you know, sometimes girls are uncomfortable with blah-de-blah, I don't remember what else I said. But he was taken aback, and I had the real sense that in that moment he got it, that he just never thought about it like that before. Hey, times, they are a-changing. And you and I have been given permission by our culture to stand up for what's right. Your uncomfortable feelings, the truth that's been inside of you all along, is being given a voice. So use that voice. Use the power that voice has to make a difference. Now let me ask you a question. What are the chances you will be hit by a speeding train going 80 miles an hour? And how much time do you spend worrying about speeding train accidents? I mean, it could happen. It does happen. But what are the chances that in the next couple of years you will be involved in some kind of car accident, anything from a fender bender to a head-on crash? I don't know about you, but in my life I've never been in a speeding train accident, but I've been in about 6 or 7 car accidents, ranging from parking lot bumper benders to flipping my car and landing upside down in a ditch. So I'm a pretty cautious driver. I know there are potential dangers every time I get in the car, but not from speeding trains. But what if instead of being a cautious driver or happily going about my business, being sure to adjust my mirrors properly, making sure my tires were in good condition with adequate pressure, etc., what if I was only worried about speeding trains? I could just avoid any roads that might cross train tracks, and I could be rather nonchalant about every other potential danger. I could have not a care in the world about defensive driving techniques or paying attention to warning signs along the way. Why worry? No speeding trains here. When it comes to child sexual abuse, I think this is an apt analogy. When we compare our overemphasis on child abductions and stranger danger, rather than worrying about sexual predators our children might actually encounter, it makes sense because the thought of our children being abducted and what could happen is so horrific, so devastating, and irrevocable that the fear sometimes kicks our protective instincts into overdrive in that one direction. And we sure need to be careful and smart when it comes to speeding trains and pedophiles lurking in playgrounds. But the reality is, the likelihood of your child being abducted versus the likelihood of your child being abused by someone you know and trust is simply too close to my analogy to be ignored. An estimated 20% of American children have been sexually molested. Offenders are usually family, friends, or relatives. According to the FBI, most cases of child abuse, the predator grooms the victim and/or their parents. Many establish themselves as the kind of person you wouldn't suspect as being a sex offender. He or she is just too nice, an upstanding community member who helps people. This allows the offender to become embedded in the community and involved in socially responsible activities like youth groups, churches, and schools, which can offer access to a number of potential victims without being suspected. This causes parents to drop their guard and allow access to their children. One day I listened back to my podcast on sex interviews with bishops in the Mormon Church. Frankly, I was a little ashamed at my timidity in asking the church to change. But I also know that the real change has to come from members anyway. This church has been and always will be, a member-inspired, bottom-to-top, top-to-bottom church. It's up to us, the rank-and-file members, the soldiers in the trenches, to keep our kids safe. And it's up to us to keep asking for training for bishops in the church, as well as anyone else who might be in a position as a trusted adult to receive information about abuse from a child. I had a case of a boy whose father advanced to a leadership position in his congregation. What a wonderful occasion for the family. But I wonder how this child felt. This child who believed in the church and must have felt very confused that God would place such a great amount of trust and approval in his dad. His dad, who had, for a long time, years, been coming into his room at night for oral sex. I know it's gross, but just stick with me. This boy, this man's son, performed oral sex on this man to completion hundreds of times. This child loved his dad. And this guy was one of the nicest men you would ever meet. He would do anything for anyone, the salt of the earth. He was a pedophile, but not a sociopath. Maybe we think of predators as malignant, narcissistic, amoral, non-feeling sociopaths. Sometimes they are. Some have no guilt, no shame, no regret. But it's not always the case. Some have actual guilt, and they do make attempts to stop their actions. Yet given all the premeditative grooming that goes into victimization, it's difficult to understand this. In order to continue this behavior, they rationalize, justify, blame, and compartmentalize. They learn to lead devil lives quite well. Back to the example of the boy and his father. I wonder how many times this kid made an escape attempt. How many trial balloons did he send up? How many times did he dip his toe in the water to test the environment? The victimization process. There is a victimization process the child has gone through over time, including phases of grooming and silencing. And again, the child has these two fears. The kind of fear is real, things that will most likely happen. The family will break up, dad will go to jail, the family will not have enough money, they may lose their home. Second kind of fear is of things that might not really happen, but the abuser has suggested, such as, I will kill your dog if you tell, or the police will come and take you away. Sometimes children are too young to be able to explain what's happening in words, or even know what's happening, or the child may feel bad about getting someone in trouble. They are constantly being shamed. The child is afraid of the parents' anger if they find out. The child is confused and has been told it's a game. Children are afraid of bringing reality into a pretend okay or happy family, and of disrupting the family and saddening the parents. When we talk to children in age-appropriate ways about our bodies, sex, and boundaries, children understand what healthy relationships look like. It teaches them they have the right to say no. They become less vulnerable to people who would violate their boundaries, and are more likely to tell you if the abuse occurs. Start early and talk often. Use everyday opportunities to talk about sexual abuse. Be proactive. If a child seems uncomfortable or resistant to being with a particular adult, ask why, and don't give up. Teach children it's against the rules for adults to act in a sexual way with them, and use examples. Teach them what parts of their bodies others should not touch. Mention that an abuser might be an adult friend, family member, or older youth. Teach children not to give out personal information on the internet, including email addresses, home addresses, and phone numbers. What else can you do? You can put potential abusers on notice that you are paying attention. If you're posting things about child abuse on your Facebook page, they're probably not going to bother your family. Talk to other adults about sexual abuse. You raise the consciousness of your community and influence their choices about child safety. You may be offering support and information to an adult whose child is experiencing abuse. They may not know what to do. And again, put potential abusers on notice that you are paying attention. I'm going to talk about what pedophilia is in a minute, but first I'm going to say a little bit more about grooming. Grooming is a process by which the offender draws a victim into a sexual relationship and maintains that relationship in secrecy. Grooming is a gradual, calculated process that snares children into a world in which they will eventually go along with the sex abuse. Through the process, the predator gains increased power over the child with the goals that the chance the child will disclose the abuse is much less, even if he were to be discovered. By grooming the family and family members, even a spouse or partner may not believe the victim. This is very important to the molester. He must maintain control over perceptions. It's best to think of the stages as 1. Targeting a victim, 2. Gaining trust, 3. Filling a need for the victim or the victim's family, 4. Isolating the child, which includes separating them from peer groups and finding ways to be alone with the child, 5. Sexualizing the relationship, and 6. Maintaining control. Pedophilia is defined as a fantasy or act of sexual activity with children who are generally age 13 or younger. But the real issue is prepubescence. Once a child begins to develop an adult body, pedophiles will lose interest and move on to a younger child in the family or other child. Survivors are aware of this and take an enormous burden on themselves in a desire to protect younger siblings. They may also begin to resent their developing bodies, as this may be the beginning of their inability to distract the abuser from other children. Pedophiles are usually men and can be attracted to either or both sexes. How well they relate to adults of the opposite sex varies. The prevalence of pedophilic disorder is unknown, but the highest possible prevalence in the male population is 3-5%. The prevalence in the female population is thought to be a small fraction of the males. If the predator is not at least age 16 and at least 5 years older than the child victim in question, it is not considered to be a case of pedophilia. And also a relationship between a person in late adolescence who is involved in an ongoing sexual relationship with a 12 or 13-year-old is not considered pedophilia. The causes are not known. There is no clear evidence that pedophilia may run in families. Theories regarding personality, history of childhood sexual abuse, hormones, brain chemistry, or brain structure all continue to be studied, but there are no proven explanations. Consumption of child pornography is even more reliable indicator of pedophilia than history of molestation. Child pornography may be used for a variety of purposes, ranging from private sexual gratification or trading with other collectors, to preparing children for abuse as part of a child grooming process. Well, this hasn't been exactly my most lighthearted, fun episode, but these are things we need to talk about. This has been the Mormon Wellness Project. I'm your host, Wendy Perry. Take care, everyone.